This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
PTB Wrestling Network, welcome to this week's edition of the NWA Saturday Special. I am your co-host, Scott Criscolo, as always, with a doctor, Dr. G, Giorgio Bellino. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening to you. How are you doing? All right?
And I'll just, not too bad.
One day runs into the other day. You know?
Yeah, it's like an 11th, exactly. It is another Friday. Saturday, we are recording, but it's another Saturday if you're listening to it first thing in the morning. And thank you for joining us again. The downloads have been great. Thank you for your support. Continue supporting all the great shows here on the Place to Be Wrestling Network. This week, here on the Saturday special, we're going to start another kind of multi-week series. We just concluded our Mount Rushmore series. Please check that out. We did three Lock, Stock, and Barrels that we all agreed on. And then last week, Dr. G, you must admit, we had a tremendous episode with Callum McDougal talking about our fourth face on Mount Rushmore. And I think from this point on, Doctor, if you will indulge me, I believe what we're going to do is we'll ask every future guest we have that may not have been able to give us their fourth.
I think that's great.
So we'll see, because I mean, you can't change the other three. Harley Race, Dusty Rhodes, and Ric Flair are not moving. The fourth face can rotate. So a few months ago, maybe like 6 or 7 weeks ago, we did an episode here on the Saturday special called "The Highs and Lows." Well, actually, you know what? Before we do that, I meant to talk about this, G. Before we get into that, let me bring in our third member of our team tonight, because we have a very special guest, because I want his input on this first part of the show. He is making his NWA Saturday special debut. He's become a favorite of mine. He is an exceptional podcaster. He is the host of a tremendous show here on the feed called You Don't Know Billy Jack.
Of my favorites.
Yep, and he is a gem, like me, on our exceptional wonky show, Jenny and the Gems. And he has been doing, and I really applaud him for this, and I thank him for doing this for our feed. He has been doing some GWCW podcasts, almost like research projects for all of you and all of us. Mr. Drew Wardlaw. Drew, welcome to the Saturday special.
Thank you very much for having me, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very excited about tonight's episode.
I know you are. I know you are. Jennifer Smith is, too, because that means we don't have to talk about this guy. I don't have any episode. I think Matt Seuss is pretty thrilled too.
Yeah,
but that's all right. No, Drew. Again, he's the host of You Don't Know Billy Jack, and we'll talk more about the shows when we do plugs at the end of the show. But tremendous show. He's done so far two GWCW pod blasts, kind of research projects. One of which I was on, and I was honored to be on. And I know he just recorded a fresh one, which you'll see on the feed in the next couple of weeks. Before we get into our history lesson tonight, I want to update everybody on the current state, at least as far as we know, of the current NWA. Because let's be honest, Dr. G, we started this show for the current NWA, run, of course, by William Patrick Corbin and his crew. And, of course, COVID didn't help. And then, of course, the allegations against Dave LaGana didn't help. And they've been kind of been underground. Raven, that stupid shit. Somehow heard through the grapevine that Billy was trying to sell and that the current NWA was going under. Well, Billy Corgan went to Twitter earlier this week and stated the NWA is absolutely not shutting down. They are working to get content, trying to kind of restructure things, getting production people in and get things back on track.
He's kind of established a relationship with somebody, like he did have a good relationship with Dave. Dave really has, obviously has a lot of experience and a passion for the business. And now he's got to find somebody else that he could trust to be able to help him see his vision. You know, correct. Remember, they've been working on this for, 3-4 years. Now you got to get somebody to buy into the vision that he has with this product. And hopefully he could find somebody or find some people and get this thing rolling. But again, you know, with things really still in the status quo in the world in terms of live events, they have to figure out a way that they can, put out product where it's safe. And again, it sounded like Carnyland was more of like a Dave Lagana kind of project with Billy. So, you know, they got to figure it out. That's great news because we were a little nervous about it going away. And now I'm really excited to hear that Billy's all on board, because once things get back to normal, I want to see some NWA because I really enjoyed it.
I did too. And I knew, I mean, it was a hard one for what happened with Dave. I mean, the COVID didn't help anyway, because their show is in such a small place anyway at the GPB studios in Atlanta. So they had small crowds anyway. And
they didn't want to do, like the other companies. They didn't want to do empty arena matches. So, you know, that's just not their style. That's not what they want to do. So, because there, as you noticed, when we watched those shows, they fed off that crowd, even though it might have been 150, 200 people, that crowd made that show.
Yep, I agree with you 100%.
I don't know if the show would have been as good without the crowd, to be honest.
No, I agree with you on that. Drew, had you been paying attention to any of the current NWA?
Yes. Yeah, I was a big fan. I hadn't been able to catch every episode, but I saw a good amount of them, and it was awesome. It was great. It was like the perfect melding of retro nostalgia with legitimate good 21st century studio wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And awesome. And they, you know, they went through some tough times, like they had the Cornette thing and all the COVID stuff and Dave Lagana. It's like they're like the little engine that could. They just kind of keep trucking along through everything. So great news to hear that they're going to be continuing.
Yeah, I mean,
I was excited about that because I was worried because the NWA has really got me back into to pro wrestling. I just think the product in the last few years was kind of dull, and this really got me excited. And it just brought a little of that old school, like you were saying, Drew. I like the whole old school, but a little bit of that new school feel to it. But, you know, I don't know. I like the mixture that they did, and it really made it feel bigger than it was. You know, like, you know, everybody thought a studio show, oh, now, you know, compared to what WWF is doing or WWE is doing and AEW is doing, I don't know, it just, those shows seemed big even though it was a small crowd. They really set everything up the right way.
Yeah, perfectly done. And they used kind of the old Paul Heyman ECW thing of accentuating the positive, hiding the negatives, and really building off of what's good about that. You know, you brought up, Dr. G, how the crowd was such an important part of that. It's 150 people, but you're in this tiny little studio, and so there's such an intimate feeling of the wrestlers and the crowd, and you can kind of, like you said, you really feed off the crowd, and you respond to people almost directly there, you know?
Exactly, and then, you know, the interviews – you know, like, you know, I like when, you know, sometimes they'll go back at it, the fans, you know, like, you know, kind of like, you know, back in the 80s with the old studio show, you know, telling the fans, shut up, you know,
yeah.
You know, like, I love that little interaction. And, you know, and I just, you know, some of the guys they had, you know, no, they weren't, you know, you weren't going to get 5-star matches every time out, but they just had that good mixture of, you know, good on the stick. And they got, you could tell that they weren't being, you know, they didn't have to be scripted with their with their interviews. And then, you know, the matches were okay. I mean, there was some, you know, some pretty good matches, but I just liked the whole package together with the interviews and, you know, the interaction with the fans, the announcers. I thought Joe Galli and I thought, you know, did a good job considering. I mean, I did like Cornette at first.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cornette did do a good job. To bring that old school NWA. But, you know, that didn't work out, obviously. He gets himself in trouble all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we'll keep things monitored here on the Saturday special of what Billy Corgan's up to, and I do think he's going to come back. And there may have to be some adjustments, and I think he's trying to preserve some money, maybe get some more capital. Because we did have Dave on the show. Out of respect, I did pull the episode, but I will say this: that he did say that that NWA was originally supposed to go in the slot where AEW is. TNT did come to them.
Wow!
So that's kind of what he alluded to. I'm going to say that's kind of what he meant. I think Billy, because I think they trusted Billy TNT. But I think Billy wanted complete control, and he knew that TNT would be calling the shots. I don't think Billy Corgan wanted a TNT championship belt. That's for sure.
Found out though, Scott, quickly about that, cause we talked about the whole TNT. Apparently that was, I heard a Tony Khan on an interview. Apparently that was their idea. It was AEW's idea to name it the TNT, and then TNT bought into it, into the idea. I thought too, it seemed like it was something that they had to do, but it was actually because they didn't want to just name it a TV championship, because that's just the same verbiage used, for all the television championships. They wanted something that would be a little different.
Right. So no, I understand.
I know it's kind of off the topic here, but I just wanted to let you know, because I know you and I have spoken about it a bunch of times.
I think it's stupid, but everyone can call me an AEW hater. I wanted them to have a secondary belt, and I understand they were limited in options, but I think it's doofy, but whatever. In any event, we will keep you updated here on the status of the NWA, and hopefully we get some good news as time moves on. All right, time for the history lesson. So about 6 or 7 weeks ago, Dr. G and I did an episode here on the special called The Highs and Lows of Sweet Charlotte. Sweet Charlotte, of course, is the nickname for the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship, a belt that myself, Dr. G, and Drew hold in very, very high regard. And that's what Nick Aldis, the current world champion, calls the belt, Sweet Charlotte, which is proper. And we went through the lineage and the best champions, the shittiest champions, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought to myself, you know what, why don't we pay homage to the secondary titles that were created by the National Wrestling Alliance through the years. And I could think of three. We may talk about some others down the line, but the three big ones, we know what they are, and we're going to talk about them throughout the next three episodes. Tonight, we are going to talk about probably next to the Intercontinental title, although it's very close, it's neck and neck, probably my favorite secondary championship in all of the history of professional wrestling, and that is the NWA United States Heavyweight Championship. I have always loved that title. I actually own the replica WCW United States Heavyweight title. In fact, I think I have it on my Twitter profile, I think. I used to, anyway. And then, of course, there have been other alliterations of the belt itself.
You like the Nikita version? I guess that's what I kind of call it.
Well, I called it.
Nikita Luger held it.
But it actually, the Magnum TA was the first to wear it, but I believe it was made most popular by Mr. Wardlow's favorite wrestler, which we will talk about. We will talk about him in due course. So the NWA United States, I got to build it for you, Drew.
I know.
The United States Heavyweight title was created. Now, we do know, and we'll talk about it. We will talk about this. There are many United States titles. Every fucking NWA
there's like 11 different
offshoot had one. Of course, Dr. G, your neck of the woods, Florida had it. I think Georgia had it.
No, Florida never. Florida had a tag team, U.S. tag.
Florida
team.
Had. That's right. Florida had U.S. tag titles. That's right. That's right.
It was a trophy at one time, and then they did make belts. But
I'm pretty sure Georgia probably had one. There's probably many. We'll talk about the one, of course, created by Mid-Atlantic, which was created technically on New Year's Day 1975, and it was won by one quarter of our NWA Mount Rushmore, and that is, of course, Handsome Harley Race, who defeated Johnny Valentine, son, father of course, Greg the Hammer, a future winner of the United States title, on apparently New Year's Day 1975, which was a nice you know, a nice round number. It's kind of like winning a belt in Rio in a tournament. Harley held the belt for a couple months. Johnny Valentine beat him on March 7th. And then throughout the 70s, we had Terry Funk won it. We had a couple of vacancies. Paul Jones was a prominent winner of it. He won it, I think, three times throughout the 80s, throughout the 70s. Blackjack Mulligan won it. In fact, Blackjack Mulligan, looks like Blackjack Mulligan and Paul Jones had a pretty heated rivalry between November of 75 and, say, September of 76. The two of them won the belts back and forth. Blackjack Mulligan finally won it in December of 76. Bobo Brazil won it. And then on July 29th, 1977, it was first won by another face on Mount Rushmore, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. And over the next few years, and we talked about this feud on this week's episode of The Main Event. Please check it out. Myself, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey. The decades rivalry between Ric Flair and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Everyone talks about the trilogy in 89, et cetera, the belt, the match is 94. But their rivalry of just who is better started back in 77, 78 when they feuded for the United States title. Dr. G, do you remember, like, I mean, obviously we don't remember because we were, you know, five. But did you ever look back and find those matches from the late 70s, kind of give yourself a frame of reference? Because, I mean, the first time I remember seeing Steamboat was in the WWF. So, and we've talked about that.
No, I mean, I because I was watching NWA when I was younger. But, yeah, I've seen some of the old matches, you know, back in the 70s. And, you know, let me tell you something. Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair, I mean, they've had hundreds and hundreds of great matches. I mean, they've wrestled each other. I think Flair said he probably wrestled Steamboat the most of any wrestler that he's ever wrestled. Probably then Dusty's probably a close second. And they just put on a clinic every time. And, you know, Ricky Steamboat is, you know, one of the greatest faces of all time, you know. And I know he wanted to be a heel at one time, but it was nice that, you know, he was one of those guys that stayed a face his whole career. And, you know, you knew when Ricky Steamboat was wrestling, you were getting a good match. You never had to worry about getting a dud. And he was always going to help bring that person, you know, if he was within there with somebody green or not as good as he was going to make them look good.
Right.
And then Flair, you know, we know Flair's, I can see. So, you know, Ric Flair had the U.S. belt the most times, six reigns. He had six reigns. So not only is he a 16-time world champion, he's a six-time U.S. champion.
Correct. What are your overall thoughts on that feud, Drew, and it generating even before the world title was even thought of for both of them?
Well, so I've seen, and this, it's been a few years now, but there's some like short matches, little clips of some of the late 70s stuff. But I mean, you listen to Flair and Steamboat talk, and they say that these 70s matches blow away everything they did in the 80s. So, I mean, you can only imagine just how great that stuff has to be. And that's like, I mean, talk about Holy Grails, just having any of those matches, you know, some of their hour-long draws, like Dr. G said, they just wrestled each other so many times, all these, you know, hour-long draws around the horn, 7 days in a row, just like, I can't imagine how great that stuff has got to be, so.
And you figure it had to be second nature to them, you know, like, I think that they were so comfortable working with each other that, you know, they didn't have to overthink the match. They knew what each other was going to do, and everything just worked perfectly.
Totally.
But, you know, Ricky Steamboat, you can't say enough about him. He may not have been a great stick guy, you know, where he's going to, you know, give you the greatest promo in the world. But, you know, when he was, you know, when he got in the ring, you were always going to get a great match.
Yeah, unbelievable. And this was like a really serious money-drawing feud for Mid-Atlantic. And this was – so the U.S. belt, this was their primary singles belt because, like, they're – you know, the Mid-Atlantic, that was a tag team territory. Kind of the top titles were the tag titles. But then this was their, you know, their primary singles title. And so you had – What's the famous Blackjack Mulligan and Flair feud? The robe and hat angle, right? So you had kind of that leading into, or you kind of had that pop the territory first, and then you had the Flair versus Steamboat feud. And supposedly it was like, it was big business, you know, everyone loved it and all that. So, yeah, man, I would love to see just, I don't know how much of it exists, probably not much, but, you know, any of like the hour long draws from, you know, 1978 or something.
Yeah, it's that stuff's not easy to find, but I'll tell you this. I mean, one thing about those two guys, you knew it's just amazing, and it's amazing to think about, you know, our matches, you know, because the way everybody is today, you know, I don't know. I think though, if they had an hour match now, you know, like if they were in their prime right now, I think that people would be able to watch it because I think that's how good they were.
Absolutely,
that, I think that you could get, even though people's. You know, everybody's wants everything quick, you know, but I think watching the psychology on those two and the way they work with each other, I definitely think that Flair's had his best matches with Ricky Steamboat, and he had some great matches with Dusty too, don't get me wrong, and Harley, but Ricky and Ric Flair, I think it was just second nature to them. They were flawless in the ring together.
Yeah. Second nature. That's a great word, because you know that they probably didn't even say a word to each other going out to the ring.
No.
And maybe
no.
Yeah, beforehand, you know, and maybe not even. I know Stan Hansen talks a lot about how he wouldn't even. I mean, he was wrestling in Japan a lot, but he wouldn't talk to his opponent at all during the in the ring during the match. He used to say act and react. So it was just two guys going back and forth, feeling each other. And that's probably what Flair and Steamboat were doing. You know, just wrestling each other an hour a night all around the horn for years, you know. They probably knew exactly what each other was thinking, and they just go for it.
No doubt. And I think that's where Ric Flair kind of broke out, you know, by his matches with Steamboat.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Steamboat was such a great face. And that U.S. belt, like you mentioned, was the top belt that in the Mid-Atlantic Heavyweight Championship were the top belts in the Mid-Atlantic territory, top singles titles. And, you know, I think that definitely Ricky and Ric Flair elevated that championship. I mean, I think, you know, out of all the territories, because like I said, there's like 11 territories that had that belt. I definitely think the Mid-Atlantic area is where that belt's best known for.
Yeah, definitely.
And Flair says on the DVD, like, you know, the best matches are the ones that, you know, a couple hundred people were at, as you guys were saying.
Yeah.
I mean, that 90-minute Broadways. I mean, it's fucking crazy. I'd like to find that Flair-Blackjack hat feud. I want to find that. There's got to be some clump on YouTube where it's probably in, like, a, you know, a two-hour clump of promos and stuff. Blackjack was U.S. champion in the stretch, so that was probably one of the precipitous feuds as the U.S. title was bouncing around. So, Flair Steamboat first won it from Flair on October 21st of 77. Then Blackjack Mulligan actually won it from Steamboat. Mr. Wrestling won it. Obviously, it's a different Mr. Wrestling. That's not Tim Woods, because Tim Woods got in the plane accident, so I think it's a different Mr. Wrestling. Flair won it from him, Steamboat, Flair. Then it was vacant. And then one of my favorite guys as a kid... He was actually my first favorite WWF wrestler. Little did I realize what kind of life he led. The Superfly, Gene Snuka, won the U.S. title as we entered the 1980s. He won it in January of 79, held it till April of 80. Flair won it. And then the first father-son combo to win a major title, the Hammer, Greg Valentine, won the U.S. title in July of 80. Flair bounced around. Piper... the Hot Rod won it, and a hunk of these, 90% of these matches were in North Carolina, of course. This was Mid-Atlantic's U.S. title, I guess you could say. Flair's last U.S. title win was, now you said Dr. G, 6 U.S. title wins, because I only have 5 here. Let me take a look.
Well, he won it in WCW. 96.
Ah, yes.
I'm only looking at NWA U.S. title wins.
Very good. Yes.
That's what we got you on to keep us in line. that's right. He won the NWA U.S. title 5 times. That's right. I remember it was 96, right? Right before, right as just as the NWO got started. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
One of the biggest, one of the best U.S. champions in the early 80s, and a guy that I always liked, I thought he was a good face, and after watching some Good Mid-Atlantic on the network, a pretty good heel, was Wahoo McDaniel. Were you a Wahoo guy, Drew?
Yeah. Yeah. Wahoo, now I've only seen, you know, peak Wahoo I don't think we really have much of, you know, in the 60s and 70s or whatever, but that Mid-Atlantic stuff and then into like World Championship Wrestling and, you know, JCP in the mid 80s, he's awesome. Both, he's a great face, great heel too. Yeah, he's awesome. That's another guy that Ric Flair, you know, obviously really talks up a lot.
Flair loves him. Flair
yeah.
loves Wahoo. And he was another one, like you said, he a better heel, but you know, he did a decent job as a face as well. And but you know, Flair and Wahoo had some good matches too. If you could find some, you'd be surprised. They actually really did a good job in the ring together.
But what rewatching NWA right now on the network, one of my chrono watches, I never realized what a good heel Wahoo was. Wahoo kind of turned heel in mid 84. Started feuding with, he wasn't feuding with Flair till early 85, but he was mostly feuding with
Magnum.
Right at the beginning of 85. He was feuding with Steamboat. That's where most of that feud came from. Then there was a vacancy in 84. And him and, what's funny is him and Tully Blanchard ended up becoming a little heel team in late 84. So that's one thing I've learned nicely from my chrono watch of viewing on the network is what a great heel Wahoo McDaniel was. I know he was, I think he was a heel when he went to the AWA. So did Manny Fernandez, actually. I think he was a heel in the AWA too. But I didn't see a ton of that, but seeing his heel work in, late 84 into early 85. Then he left, I think. Then he kind of left after he beat Magnum, he kind of faded. He might've gone to AWA by then. Sergeant Slaughter had a run with the U.S. title a couple times before heading off to WWE, WWF. The Hammer won it back in April of 82, and him and Piper went back and forth. And, of course, we have to talk about a match that, in all likelihood, if you put a gun to my head right now, will probably be in my top 10. On my GWCW list, my ballot, Starrcade '83, I remember first watching this match on the Lords of the Ring tape. The PWG remembers that. PWI, and I have that DVD. Remember, we bought that DVD I bought a wrestling DVD at a horror con. only I could get away with that. And of course, I'm talking about the epic dog collar match between the Hammer and the Hot Rod. Now, common misconception, that was not a U.S. title match because Piper would win the match and then he would leave. And, of course, he would show up in the WWF by early.
Well, you know what was weird, and I think I've said this on a previous episode, it was so weird to see then Greg Valentine and Roddy Piper both be in the WWF together and, you know, after having those brutal matches and being friends, you know, in the WWF. And, you know, when you're younger, you're like, wait a second, weren't those two just beating the heck out of each other? Now they're, friendly with each other.
No.
So I remember that. I mean, that match, I mean, that's got to be in the top 10 of the GWCW. I mean, it really does. Because
it absolutely does.
People remember that. You say Greg Valentine, people know Greg Valentine for that match with Roddy Piper. I mean, and same thing for Roddy Piper. I mean, Roddy Piper's known for other things too, but I think Greg Valentine's best remembered for that match with Roddy Piper.
It's amazing, Drew. I mean, that's one that, if it's not on somebody's list, then you should be stripped of your cred.
Suspect.
At worst, it's in the top 30, but it should be it should be in the top 10. I mean, the commentary with that, with Caudle and G's guy, Gordon Solie, I mean, the crowd was fucking on there. I mean, the blood oozing out of pipes.
It's a bloodbath. Yeah.
Oh, it's so goddamn good.
Man, and what makes it even better is that there's a match. It's a hidden gem on the network that is a match of theirs. I believe it's from Georgia earlier in the year as part of their feud. And it sets up a lot of the ear work that's done in the Starrcade match. So you get kind of a preview. And then there's another match that I watched for a little while ago for GWCW. That one might also make my list too. It's from maybe the summer, maybe July or something of 83. But it's another just rocking match. Not the bloodbath, of course, of the dog collar match. But these two were awesome together. Just total mean brawling guys, you know.
It would have been neat to actually see them continue that feud in the WWF, but obviously that was going on a whole different plan at that time. But those guys were great together. I mean, and the psychology and the interviews leading up to that match were phenomenal. I mean, you know, Roddy's just great. So he's just awesome on the mic. Oh. I can listen to a Roddy Piper interview anytime.
So good. And we did a Roddy Piper episode quite a while ago. We talked about the Hot Rod, and I know we talked a lot about this match. And Piper is so great, and we know that. But let's not. I mean, we know Gorilla used to goof with him about it takes him 40 minutes to get going. Let us not forget about the Hammer and how just so methodically sound he was as he is or was as a worker. I mean, he was just he reminds me a lot of Harley in the promo firing sense. Very stoic, didn't raise his voice much. When he did, you knew it. I mean, Drew, we can always loud the platitudes of Hot Rod, but let's not forget that Takes Two to Tango. And the Hammer is one of the greatest heel foils of any feud from 78 to 86.
Well,
wherever he was.
Oh, yeah. He was awesome. And he's awesome in 1992 WCW.
Yeah, he was.
Kind of putting around on the undercard. There's a match at Beach Blast with it's him versus Marcus Bagwell. That's awesome. It's like this cool veteran versus, you know, rookie type match.
I do remember that.
Greg Valentine just beats him up, you know? It's awesome. He's great.
So then
Greg Valentine's a good, you know, was a good upper mid-card guy. He was a guy that the whole Intercontinental belt, the whole US belt, just the perfect guy, perfect mid-card guy that, you know, it could give you a main event if need be. But just always solid, and you could put, you know, any green guy with him, and he was gonna give him a good match or give you a good match.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're not gonna have any problems with either of those guys. So Piper would leave, of course, and head to the WWF. Hammer would lose the title to Dick Slater, and Slater at the time was a heel because remember he was one of the henchmen with Harley and Bob Orton in the Flair feud. Mm-hmm. And then we had a hint of a Valentine babyface run, very, very hint. And then, of course, Hammer would leave and would go to the WWF and eventually win later that year in 84, win the Intercontinental title from Tito. Wahoo and Steamboat would putt around in 84 with the belt going back and forth. And then coming out of Mid-South in March of 85, we would have Magnum TA. Magnum would hold it for a few months. He would lose the title to former television champion a couple weeks before he lost the TV title at the Great American Bash to Dusty Rhodes. And we're talking about Tully Blanchard, which leads us, gentlemen. You know, I talked about on the main event this week that there is a Flair Steamboat match that's in my top three and could be my number one. This match that we're about to talk about is also in my top three. Another match that's in my top three, Drew, is a match you and I talked about on one of our research project pods that you're doing, which, by the way, again, I want to say again, are exceptional. Two are on the feed already. As you mentioned to me, a third is already in production. Ha ha, you like that industry?
Oh, yeah.
But You and I, when I was on the second one, we talked about that match, but that's another topic for another day. And I'm, of course, talking about Starrcade 85, The Gathering, for the United States Championship. Two stips, one match. You didn't see that too much back then. Not only was it an I Quit match, it was in a cage. Magnum TA and Tully Blanchard.
Oh, I love that.
That's one of those matches I could watch anytime. It's like listening to Billy Joel. I could watch that match anytime, anywhere, any place, and not go, nah, I'm not in the mood. I am always in the mood for that match, Dr. G.
I love that match. I love when he puts the, you know, the into the his eye, the piece of wood into his eye. I love it. Ah, I love that match.
That is controlled. That's
I may
what you
have to watch that match before I go to sleep tonight.
That's what you call, Drew Wardlaw, controlled storytelling violence.
Oh, brother. So, yeah. I mean, we're going to get to who's probably the greatest U.S. champion of all time a little later. And and he is one of my guys, certainly. But Magnum TA is another one of my guys. And, I mean, when you talk about the U.S. championship, there's the guy later that we'll talk about. But if we're being honest, it's this guy, Magnum TA, and it's this feud that you should think of when you think of the U.S. championship. Scott, you said that, you know, this match is in your top three. I mean, I'll just say right now, this match is going to be my number one on the WCW list. This is the match that this is my favorite match of all time, my single favorite match of all time. I think it is the best example of professional wrestling ever in the history of the sport, of this great sport.
Wow.
I think it is so transcendently special that it's like, anyone can watch it and you'll get something out of it. I mean, we did a You Don't Know Billy Jack episode on this match, and it's like, it's so just the grainy footage. There's blood. There's this weird sexual tension between the two guys, because, you know, and there, you know, you have that back and forth with Baby Doll, kind of as the feud heats up, and, you know, Magnum is kissing Baby Doll, and you have David Crockett, of course, freaking out on the mic. You have them screaming at each other through the match, just these like unholy howls. And then you have the finish of the match. You've got Magnum throwing the belt over his shoulder and just looking disgustedly at Tully as Tully's just laying on the floor. And he just walks out wearing those cowboy boots, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, man, oh, man. I might have to join Dr. G and watch this one before bed tonight. What an incredible match.
I think Dr. G, you and I have to we may have to do a Saturday special later in the year on just Starrcade 85. Because I think that, I mean, I'm looking at the card now. That is easily, and that might be a night we get Chad on. I think Starrcade 85 is one of those seminal pay-per-views in the history of this business. I really do.
Oh, yeah.
You're coming at the year that, like, 83 was great, 84 wasn't bad, but the same year that WWF did WrestleMania 1, Crockett does Starrcade 85, and I it's hard to argue if Starrcade might be slightly better, you know?
Yeah. It's just so different. You know, what a great example of the two different promotions and how they present professional wrestling, you know? The glitz and the glamour and, like, the pageantry and the presentation of WrestleMania 1 versus just the – I mean, everybody bleeds in that darn Starrcade 85 show.
Yeah.
I mean, I always say, Drew – If they had that mind of Vince McMahon in terms of promoting and marketing and all that,
yep.
I mean, we know that at that time, and we even say it on the NWA Crock and Roll, which will be airing next week. We say that the wrestling in the 80s, especially the mid 80s, was much better in the NWA than it was the WWF. But the WWF had the star power, had the marketing, the glitz and the glamour that.
Yep.
But I, even as a kid, I mean, I was an NWA guy. You know, that's
yeah.
I grew up in Florida, so that's what we watched.
Yeah, they've got. I mean, WWF, they have the aesthetic. There's no doubt about it. And it remains to this day. I mean, people, you know, say what you will about it, but Vince McMahon, there's a lot you can say about him, but he has that mind, and he has like this very specific idea and aesthetic of what he wants it to be, and he executes it. Good for him.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
So Magnum wins it, wins the title on that night, and then holds it for a little bit. There's issues with him and Nikita. Nikita wins it in August, and then, of course, Magnum was supposed to move on to a world title feud with Flair. We all know what happened to Magnum, which is a fucking shame. And then, on July 11th, 1987, Drew Wardlaw's life changed forever.
Forever.
Forever. Because, baby, it's time for a little flexi-lexi. Now, this title reign, of course, we're talking about the total package himself, Lex Luger. Now, this reign is not as big a deal as the second reign. The second reign is amazing because of its length. Luger won the belt here, and then Dusty would beat him in actually not a bad match. I thought it was a moderately pretty good match at Starrcade 87.
Yeah, their feud is actually pretty good. I mean, you think of 87 Lex Luger and 87 Dusty Rhodes, and a lot could go wrong there, but it's actually pretty good. Dude, it's not great, but it's pretty solid. And I do want to give some special shine to the Magnum TA versus Nikita Koloff feud, because they had that awesome best of seven series throughout the summer of 86 on the Bash tour. Mm-hmm. And a great angle leading up to it, where they're doing a contract signing and Nikita insults Magnum's mom. And so Magnum attacks Nikita, forces I think the belt, it's like it's vacated or something, right? I think Jim Crockett Jr. strips him of the title, and then they do the best of seven series after that. So that's really good, and there's some awesome matches in there too.
That's right. That was a big feud. I remember. You know, again, you know, Magnum was going to be the NWA champion. So
yeah,
I mean, it's a shame because he was getting ready to take off, and that feud with Nikita was great. I really enjoyed some of those matches.
Yeah, and man, you guys were talking about who would be the fourth face on the Mount Rushmore. Magnum, if he hadn't gotten in that car crash, he probably would have been that fourth face.
I agree.
Easily. And you could have had a pretty good top of the NWA on the heel face side if you had, you know, face Magnum as world champion, heel Luger as U.S. champion, and eventually maybe those two could have some together. And then Drew would have really lost his mind.
Can you imagine?
How did you become a Lex Luger fan? I'm not sure of your age. So like, did you watch him when he originally, started, or was it more from watching, YouTube or, old stuff?
Yeah. So I grew up, I was a WCW guy. Diehard. Till the very end. So I started watching very late 89, early 90. And so I liked Lex Luger then, because, he turned and he was a good guy and he was big and strong. And I liked him then. I liked him through the Nitro era, really liked him then. That him in 97 in the summer heating up towards his title win when he's just racking everybody and going nuts. So I liked him all through then. As I got older, into the 2000s, took a break from wrestling. When I came back, that's when I did not like Lex Luger. And I will admit that. I have had a tumultuous relationship with the Total Package.
Tumultuous.
But I didn't like him for a time and thought he was lame. And I bought into those lies, guys. I can't believe it. But when the network launched, I went back and I was watching the Nitros from 95, the early Nitros, 95, 96.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I turned the corner for good. on Lex and just realized how amazing he is. And then I went back and, you know, was watching the rewatching like all the pay-per-views and stuff from the early 90s. And that's, you know, then it's like, geez, this guy's awesome. You know, and so I've kind of gone back and watched everything again.
You know, I like Lex Luger. I'm obviously not as big of a fan as you are, but I do like Lex, the guy from Florida. But what I was saying, I think I'll talk a little bit about it on the Croc and Roll show is that Lex, if he was humble like he is now, I mean, when you hear him in interviews, it's like a totally different guy. And he had it. He just didn't always have his mind in the right place. He didn't. He wasn't always focused. He has that focus that he has now. He had it back then. He probably would have been one of the greatest champions.
Yeah.
In the wrestling business, he just at times just didn't have that passion. Again, he didn't grow up being a wrestling fan, so it wasn't. You know, he didn't have that same kind of like, oh, I always wanted to be a wrestler type of thing, But I did think he did a pretty decent job at times. I thought he did a decent job in the Four Horsemen. I know he gets a lot of flack and everything, but I thought he had a pretty good run there with the Four Horsemen. And I think, you know, when they tried to do the Lex Express thing with him, WWF, I think if he embraced it a little bit more, and wrestling, the wrestling business was, was not so great at that time either. But I wish they would have let him win the championship because I would have loved to just seen what would have happened. You know, maybe we would have had a different outcome than we thought it would have.
For sure. Yeah. It's tough. He's I think we talked about this on a recent Jenny in the Gyms. Is that he has a lot working against him in the wrestling business in terms of like, I do think there was a lot of jealousy because he got pushed. I mean, right away, even in Florida.
Mm-hmm. No, he won the Southern Heavyweight Championship, I think, within like a few months in the business.
Yeah. Yeah. And was pushed so heavily in the magazines, Flair famously did not really like him. He, by all accounts, you know, like you said, Dr. G had a bad attitude a lot of the time, was a guy that he was one of the first to have an agent in pro wrestling. And
he was also one of the first guys. He was also one of the first guys in the business who wasn't a fan as a kid.
Yeah.
Like he didn't grow up with it. He was a football player who had nothing better to do. And instead of adapting to it, Kind of like Don King with Mike Tyson, kind of like, you don't have to like these guys. They're jealous of you because you're a fucking Adonis of a body and they're a bunch of fat beer-guzzling slugs. And somebody got in his ear, and that's how he acted for the next fucking 13 years. And,
yeah, totally.
And unfortunately, that sucks because I think a guy – and Luger has had some good matches, a few. And he could have been an amazing heel and a pretty decent babyface. We won't get into the WWF stuff. That's another show, another topic for another show. But he probably, had he respected the business, look, Goldberg eventually, the problem was Goldberg and Luger were almost the same kind of guy. Mm-hmm. The difference was Goldberg figured out what he needed to do and Luger never did.
Yeah. And I mean,
that's
Goldberg,
the difference.
Goldberg just had that like undeniable off the charts charisma that, I mean, Lex Luger is a charismatic guy in his own way, but I mean, nowhere near what Goldberg has, you know?
Well, again, he's charismatic. Like I said, if it was the Lex of now, obviously the physical shape he's in now, but you know, like it's the Lex of now, his attitude, and you know, he's a very good speaker. He's just a different person. If he was that person back then, wow, he could have been just like we say even about Psycho Sid or Sid Justice, whatever you want to call him. He's got 9,000 names. But he, another guy that just didn't have his whole heart into the business and a guy that could have been a great champion. I think Lex could have done that. And it's a shame because I like when Lex turned face and when, you know, in his WWF run, I was so excited. Mm-hmm. Was like, oh my gosh, maybe this could be the next Hulk Hogan, you know, because we didn't know all the behind the scenes like we do now.
Right.
And I wish he just had that attitude, that humble attitude that he has now back then. And I think, boy, he, you could have, Vince could have taken him places at that time.
Yeah, that would have done so much. And I did bring this up on Jenny in the Gyms episode, but watching the something I talk about a lot is the unedited raw footage of the Lex Express, where it's like 3 hours.
Oh, but, yes, I've seen some of that.
And it's like, it's first of all, it's hilarious, but also, I mean, the guy, like, he's just kind of complaining the whole time. He's not very likable, you know, as that all-American good guy babyface. That's just not – that's not him, you know. He's
it wasn't
likeable.
Him at that time.
At that time, exactly. Time. Yeah. Yeah. And you do get that sense of kind of like arrogance and being too good for what he's doing. And I will say I don't like to talk about like, oh, the booking and the, you know, they shouldn't have done this or done that, but he did land in some tough spots, mm-hmm. being turned back and forth a lot. I mean, you had the thing in 90 with, you know, him being put in the Wrestle War 90 match. They had to turn him face really quick, and I mean, that's his best match ever, and he's incredible in it, and the match is incredible, but it's, you know, it's just he's back and forth, and then he turns again in 91 when he wins the belt, and just all this stuff. So it's there's just a lot working against him kind of on all fronts, but it begins and ends with him and his attitude, I think.
I think that's the only thing that really killed him. He had the look. No, was he ever going to be a five-star match wrestler? But Hulk Hogan wasn't. I mean, I'm not that type of person. I think if he had the charisma and he was supposed to be, like, you know, strong and more of a monster kind of guy,
mm-hmm.
I just think it's a shame because, like I said, I don't know if he'll come out and totally say that in an interview today, but I think if you sat with him one-on-one, and he probably would say to you, hey, you know what, if I had a better attitude back then,
yeah,
I probably could have gone further than I did. And I mean, he still made a great living for what he, you know, even with his limitations and his attitude. So yeah. Again, could you imagine if he didn't have that, those issues?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he really just had, you know, for lack of a better word, total package. He really did.
Yeah.
I mean, he had the perfect name.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, look, all that aside, his run, his first run, 80, I mean, he's okay in 87, 88 to 91. He's pretty awesome. And the peak of that is this 89 title run that we're right in the middle of talking about here.
Yes, we are. Yep. Just to recap. So after Dusty beats him at Starrcade 87, there's a vacancy. Barry Windham wins a tournament. He holds a belt for most of 88 into early 89. Luger beats him at Chi-Town Rumble. Has the belt for 76 days. Then Michael Hayes wins it for some fucking weird reason. He holds it for 15 days. And then Luger beats him on May 22nd, 1989. He holds the belt for 523 days until Halloween Havoc 1990 when he loses to, oh my God, Drew's second favorite wrestler in the history of the universe, a guy who does not have Lex Luger's physique by any stretch of the imagination, Valariat Stan Hansen. Could you, Dr. G, you've got to give me credit. Where on this wonderful country of the United States of America was I going to find not only a Luger fan, but a Stan friggin' Hansen fan?
I have to say, Drew, you are the first person I've ever met or heard of that Stan Hansen. And not that Stan's bad, don't get me wrong, but I just never heard anybody say Stan Hansen's their favorite wrestler. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, look, Stan Hansen truly is my number one. I love Lex, but Stan Hansen is my number one.
Stan the Lariat.
Stan the Lariat. I love
that
him.
That nearsighted son of a bitch that's broken so many fucking noses. And not even realizing it.
Now, how did that come to be? Because, you know, he did wrestle a lot over in Japan. So
yeah, so that he was a later discovery for me. When I came back to wrestling in probably 2008-ish, I stopped watching when WCW went out of business because I figured, okay, they lost the war. That's it. Then 2008, I started rewatching the Attitude Era stuff. because I didn't see a lot of that Raw and stuff at the time. So I started watching that, and I saw JBL when he was in the Blackjacks doing, you know, he was doing essentially a Stan Hansen gimmick.
Pretty much.
And I was talking to a friend of mine who was a wrestling fan, and I was saying, yeah, dude, I'm watching this stuff. This JBL, or he was, you know, Blackjack Bradshaw at the time. Yeah, he does this really gnarly lariat, this clothesline. It's awesome. Clothesline from hell, he calls it. And the guy, Justin, who said, yeah, that's what Stan Hansen does. He's doing a Stan Hansen gimmick. So I went and got on YouTube or whatever and started watching Stan Hansen stuff. And it's like, what? Like, just this giant, weird-looking cowboy with a bunch of – and I had seen him in WCW at the time, but just totally forgot. You know, I was young at the time, and he didn't have a big run. But, dude, the guy is constantly moving around the ring – and is mean and just beating up these guys in Japan, no less. And he's freaking out. He's running over the girls that have the flowers. He's hitting fans with a giant rope. It's like, what is going on? So
the guy's crazy.
He's crazy. So I dove all in. I've read his book. His book is awesome. I've got an autographed picture of him hanging up in the cubicle at my work. It's, oh, wow. Yeah. He's
now,
the man.
Did you like that match with him and Luger? The was it the strap match?
Dude, their matches are good. So they've got what is it, two or three? They've got Halloween Havoc. They've got Starrcade. And do they have a match in between there? I can't remember.
Well, he wins the belt. That's right. He wins it at Starrcade. And I don't know if – well, you know what? I can go to – I'm looking at this. Why don't you look at the fucking thing, Scott, you dumbass? And no, it looks like they wrestle at Halloween Havoc when Stan Hansen wins, and then they don't wrestle again. Where Stan Hansen wins, and then Luger beats him in the bull rope match at Starrcade, and that's it.
Okay, yeah. So they're both good. They're both good matches. I mean
– now, Luger loses it in the strap match, right? Isn't the strap match when they have to hit all the turnbuckles?
No, it was the strap match.
The match at Halloween Havoc, according to cagematch.net, the match at Halloween Havoc was not a strap match. It was just a straight up match. The match at Starrcade was a bull rope match. And Luger won that one.
I remember there was one. You know what's the match called where they have to touch each turnbuckle?
That's a strap match.
Yeah, it's a strap match. It's a bull. That was.
I remember.
Didn't they have to do that?
They could be both. You could do, because technically, if you remember the, I mean, obviously not in the era we're talking, but when JBL won the title from Eddie at Bash 04, that was a bull rope match, but they did strap rules. They touched the turnbuckles. So I guess it depends on what you're tied to.
Yeah,
because you know.
I vaguely remember that match. This is all coming from memory. This is not looking anything up or anything. It's just coming from memory back. You know, I vaguely remember them having a similar match to that. And I remember it was a pretty good match. I enjoyed it. But I could be missing, you know, getting myself confused. Who knows? But I just remember Stan Hansen and Luger having a feud there for a while. And that match happening.
So,
but it's... You know, it's funny because Stan Hansen, you know, again, you know, he would come in for those cups of coffee, you know, maybe wasn't getting the payday he wanted in Japan, come to the U.S. for a little bit. But, you know, he never really stayed very, very long.
Right. So Luger wins it at Starrcade. And then by 91, it's officially called the WCW U.S. title, which is where we'll stop because that's not this show is not our purview of that. So in the, you know, 16 years between 1975 and 1991, we've had some amazing U.S. champions. We would say probably the greatest U.S. champions. I mean, we could name them all. I mean, Harley, Steamboat and Flair, you know, Magnum.
You got to give Lex his props.
Lexi. Yeah. That's probably the best. They're probably the best ones. This was a lot of fun, guys. This was a lot of fun. Drew, tell listeners who may not know you that are new to the feed and are new to the network. Tell us briefly what is
your exceptional show, You Don't Know Billy Jack. What do you guys give us a little background on what it is? I'm trying to do that to all the new listeners.
Sure. So what it is, it's a live watch show. It is me and my good friend Jordan, my best friend Jordan, in fact. So we watch matches together. So the hook is he's a non-wrestling fan. So if you guys have heard Jeff Learns Wrestling, it's kind of a play off of that. Jordan's a non-wrestling fan. I'm a diehard wrestling fan. And I created a list of, you know, what are generally considered by a lot of people to be like the best matches ever. So there's all kinds of stuff. There's old 80s Lucha stuff. There's New Japan stuff, All Japan, some WWF matches, WCW, NWA, all kinds of stuff. And we just watch one of those, and I just get to hear him react to the match, and we kind of talk about it after. So you end up getting some really cool insights. I mean, like hearing him talk about, you know, Magnum versus Tully, for instance, was awesome. I think that was maybe our fourth episode. So just really cool stuff. It's a lot of fun. And we're actually going to have I'm going to be recording an episode within – I'm going to really try to get something out this month. You know, obviously with everything going on, we can't do it in person. We live right around the corner from each other, but we may try to do a Skype thing, or I may end up making my wife stand in and watch some kind of crazy match or something and hear her get mad at me.
No, that's so great. That's great.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a lot of fun, though. I like doing it. So.
Oh, that's awesome. No, my goal here in the Saturday special, also as the purveyor of Place to Be Wrestling Network, is when I get people on that have shows and you're a brand new listener to the feed, I want everyone to kind of get acclimated to some of the great stuff we have here. So thank you, Drew. It's an honor. It's been great to have you on tonight, and check him out. You Don't Know Billy Jack, check out the GWCW Podblast. He did an intro one with Ryan Everett, and then I was on with Ryan and Drew for part two. We talked about the Dangerous Alliance, and that was an exceptional episode. And that's where the other of the three matches that I don't know where is going to be one, what's going to be two, and what's going to be three. And as he had mentioned to me, there's one in the pipeline. So
yep, coming up. And I'll just give a little preview of that one if I could. That is going to be on the Marquis or the Marquess of Queensberry Cup match or matches in 1994 between Ric Flair and Lord Steven Regal.
Well, well, well. Drew, if you want, you are amazing, my friend. I'll tell you why. If you go about a few, if you go two main event episodes ago on our last GWCW Classic Match Pick segment, Steve Willey picked.
Oh, that did he really?
Set of matches. Yes, he
did. I try to keep up with the main event, and I've missed a couple. Darn
that,
it.
That is quite all right. I highly recommend, if you need a guest, talk to Mr. Willie. He would probably enjoy being on with you.
Okay,
because he picked the Flair, and I loved it. Gee, yeah. We may have to watch it. It's on YouTube, G. It's like – the clip is like 55 minutes, but it's got all the – it's really great. It's really great. We'll have to watch it, G. See that. You'll like it.
Man, okay, well, I hope I'm not going to be clogging up the feed here.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. We want people to have as much stuff for them to digest when creating their GWCW match ballot. So the more the merrier. That's what I say.
Well, I'll get in touch with him and get him on, because it's first of all, it's awesome, but it's a totally weird, one-off thing. And if you think about it's just a matter of weeks before Hogan comes into the company.
Yep, yep.
So
you're right.
It's just this bizarre, just stark contrast.
It really is. It really is. But Drew, thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
A pleasure to have you on. And you'll be back.
Privilege is all mine. Yeah, thanks a lot.
You'll
be back. This is a lot of fun to talk to you.
No,
guys.
You will definitely be back. Dr. G, of course, you can. By the way, you can find Drew on Twitter at Fighting Spirit,
right? Underscore Burning Spirits.
Burning Spirits. Thank you. I knew it was Spirit. Underscore Burning Spirits. And look at me. I'm just now. Somebody's gonna get some weird you know, some weird, you know, who's this guy?
Yeah,
yeah, no. Dr. G, you can find him at KFC 14360. Of course, you can find me at PTB Podfather. Next week on the Saturday special, we will continue talking about some of the greatest other champions in NWA history. And we will talk about a lot of people's personal favorite title in the history of wrestling, the World Television Championship. Yes, the red belt, baby. We're going to talk about that next week. Yes. So we're going to have a lot of fun with it. Drew, always a pleasure. He's Drew. I am Scott. He is the doctor. And even Flexi Lexi is not.